Good afternoon. I'd like to call House Judiciary Committee meeting to order. Today is Wednesday, April 12th, and let the record reflect it is 1:05 p.m. Today we have present Representative Johnson, Representative Groh, Representative Carpenter, Representative Gray, Vice Chair Allard, and myself, Chair Vance. I would like to remind committee members and those in the audience to please silence your cell phones. The staff assisting us today is Sophia Tenney with House Records and Talia Ames of the Juno LAO. Thank you for your work. On today's agenda, the committee will bring back House Bill 68, Crime of Sex and Human Trafficking, from the Governor, as presented by the Criminal Division of the Alaska Department of Law. I have requested a committee substitute for this bill based upon many of the concerns that members have shared, as well as changes by request from the Department of Law. It is not a perfect version, and I just want to say thank you to our legislative legal and Claire specifically for all the work and the back and forth. So there's going to be a few more small changes that we have in this, but we wanted to get this before the committee so that we can have it as a working document. Vice Chair Allard, may I have a motion?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move the committee adopt the new CS version HB 6833GH1029S as the committee new working document.
And I would object for discussion if I might.
Thank you. I would now ask that my committee A.J. Galmeda and Deputy Attorney General Ms. Casey Schroeder to come to the table and walk the committee through the explanation of changes. And you have members have also been provided an updated version of those changes. And if you two could please state your names for the record. Before you do that, I would like to welcome Representative Eastman to the table with the continued conspiracy about our chairs.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Jake Almeida, Chief of Staff to Representative Vance, and committee aide to this House Judiciary Committee.
Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General for the Criminal Division of the Department of Law.
Thank you. The CS before you, version Sierra, makes a number of changes that was in consultation between the chair and the Department of Law. So that is many of the changes you see before you. I will just read from the top. Any of the sections not numbered on the explanation of changes before you means that they were previously existed in version alpha of the bill and were not changed. They were likely reformatted, and the way they're numbered in the sections now is not how they were numbered in the previous version. But again, if they're not mentioned, it's because they were in version alpha of the bill and it was only formatting changes. So with section 4, we remove the terms place of prostitution and prostitution enterprise from sex trafficking in the first degree. And we raise the minor age of the victim from 20 to 21. This was a change preferred by the chair. In section 5, we do the same thing, raise the age, the minimum age from 20 to 21. In section 8, we add new language to human trafficking in the third degree, specifically, where's that? Yeah, 1141.367, we added the words may reasonably be construed. That was a change pointed out by Alleged Legal that we should make, and that is there before you. The chair also wanted to add the provision of forfeiture property from those who are convicted of human and sex trafficking, and the sales of that forfeited property of that defendant will be provided as resources to victims of sex trafficking. That's what we're doing in that section. In section 11 is the main changes of the bill from the one before me. So section 11, we made the full separation in statute of prostitution and sex trafficking, and we added a first, second, third, and fourth degree of prostitution. So prostitution in the first and second degree are those who are, the term was used, John, but in this case we'll be saying the recidivist patron, a patron of prostitution is who these degrees apply to. And same thing with prostitution in the third degree, and prostitution in the fourth degree remains the same as existing law, that a sex worker who commits prostitution in the fourth degree is still a Class B misdemeanor. That has not changed. In Section 12, we made conforming changes. Section 13, we added, per the chair's request, the legislature. This is similar to the other section I just mentioned, the sale of forfeiture property of those convicted of human and sex trafficking. That money will be provided as resources to victims of sex trafficking. It says restitution. That will be a change that we will make in a future amendment. It should say resources, as it does a few pages prior. Section 20. This revokes a defendant's business license if they're convicted of any human or sex trafficking or patron of a victim of sex trafficking charges. That will likely be changed in a future amendment. The chair's intent was to look for any official license that's produced by the state that someone has to get from a state board or around children, that they would not, if you're convicted of any of those crimes, that you are not to hold a license. So this section will likely need some work, but that is the intent of what we were going for. Section 22 adds prostitution in the first or second degree to those that the Alaska court may not suspend an imposition of entry of judgment. Section 23 does the same thing. Prostitution of first or second degree, the court may not suspend an imposition of sentence for those individuals. Section 25 makes technical and conforming changes as it corrects the cross-reference to indecent viewing or production of pictures. Section 26 makes technical and conforming changes only. Sections 29 through 32 expands the privacy protections. This was pointed out by the Department of Law to victims of any sex offense or sex trafficking offense, that the records, while the case is in court, will not use the victim's name out of privacy. It will use something else that is not their legal name to protect their privacy. Section 33 is a conforming change based on the majority of changes that were made in Section 11. Section 35 removes misdemeanor drug charges for vacation of judgment provisions. This was a decision made by the chair that this new policy of a vacation of judgment in this bill that the bill would be creating should only apply to those who were convicted of minor prostitution charges. So obviously there was a lot of questions and contention about the thousands potentially of those who would approach the court system about wanting a vacation of judgment for their drug charges. Again, the chair just decided that for this CES before us, that we will just have this bill only apply to those who were convicted of prostitution charges for a vacation of judgment and not misdemeanor drug charges. So that is a big change that is happening in the CES. Section 36 touches on partially what we were trying to go for in having official licenses that individuals get from the state be revoked if they are convicted of human and sex trafficking charges. So this specifically directs the Commissioner of Department of Education to revoke any teaching license from someone who's convicted of sex trafficking offenses. Section 45, conforming changes consistent with the changes made in Section 46. And Section 49 and 50 are conforming changes based on Section 11. Sections 56 through 58 are, again, more conforming changes. Section 59 was a new section added as Legislative Legal Services was drafting the CS. Because of the changes made in Section 35, with the vacation of judgment provisions, they wanted to add this provision allowing the court system to have some flexibility as it reads in implementing that provision. And upon further conversations with legislative legal, that seemed to be an oversight and is not legally necessary. So that will likely be a future amendment to remove that provision as it is not needed. And sections 60 and 61, again, just deal with the effective dates. And those are the explanation of changes. And if there are specific questions about why some of these changes were made, I'd be happy to take those. And the Department of Law can speak to their preferred changes that were made as well.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and through the Chair. Thank you for being here, Ms. Schroeder. So the first question, and I'm glad we hit on it, was Section 36. I know we heard it hit on it in Section 20. And then again for revocation of teaching licenses, but I would consider furthering that. And I'm just wondering, is there a specific reason why it's only the teaching licenses and not inclusive of like nursing licenses where, I know, sex traffickers could be enticed to do further damage, and midwife licensing, other licensing. I know you're probably going to say this opened up a big Pandora's box, and so I could tell by your expression. But it's concerning to me if somebody is sex trafficking and then they're around vulnerable individuals. And, if you could address that, I'd appreciate it.
Yeah, through the Chair, Vice Chair Allard. This was a change made by the chair's preference, and yes, it is not. This is one part of what we were looking for. There are other licenses that are given out by the state that people approach the State of Alaska for authority to have, and we are working on. Unfortunately, we will likely have to list all of them in a section, and so it will take more work. But that is a future amendment that we are working on because the chair has similar concerns.
Thank you. So are we working on that, Mr. Alameda, to come with this before it goes through out of the committee? Or can we present those amendments? I want to be respectful to the chair, so I'm trying to figure out, because I'd like to see that in it now. I don't want to wait. So.
Through the chair, yes. Those were going to be future amendments. There's going to be another amendment deadline for the CS, but the CS before you is a majority of the changes that the chair and the Department of Law were looking for before we open up another amendment deadline.
Thank you.
And if I may just answer your question directly, one of the sections talks about revoking business licenses, mm-hmm. and that was a miscommunication with legal. What my intent was more of the angle that you're going down, that if there are trusted professional licenses of that conveys a public trust, that they are convicted of the higher sex trafficking offenses, that their license be revoked, specifically those who have direct supervision over children. Take it's care. Easy for us to identify teaching licenses, but they are not the only ones. And what we were told is that we would have to specifically make a list. And I just want to clarify for the public, we are not targeting any one profession and calling any one profession traffickers. But no. This is a matter of responsibility of those who oversee children and a concern it's a trusted responsibility to have a professional license in any capacity, especially those over children. And want to make it very clear. So that I'm willing to work with you and any member of the committee on how we can do that appropriately. So Representative Gray and then Representative Eastman.
Can I just make a quick comment on your comment?
Follow-up, Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. Because I do have concern with daycare licenses. I mean, those just seem common sense. But if we don't itemize like you're saying, then we just don't know. So I appreciate you doing that for us. Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair, I know that for my particular professional license, when I renew it, I'm asked if I've been convicted of a felony conviction. If yes, then I need to explain that before I can renew my license. So it might be tricky to go to every professional organization and ask what their standards are and whether they would renew licenses for sex traffickers, but my guess is that most wouldn't. So So I'm thinking that we might be able to go down the road of finding out if they're asking about felony convictions and asking for explanations of felony convictions, that we might actually, there might already be a path for denying people renewal of licenses or granting of licenses. But I don't know if Ms. Schroeder can speak to that.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, I think that that's a good idea. I understand what the drafter's request is, and it is daunting. So I think if a phone call or, you know, testimony in the record can help address the question, I think that that would be the preferred option.
Yes, thank you. And this is why we have the conversation in committee, so that we can work this out, and the public can know that we are asking these same questions that they are and finding a solution. Representative Eastman.
Thank you, through the chair. I saw that solicitation is on the list here in Section 36. Now, I believe solicitation is not a felony. Is that right?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think it depends on what the underlying offense is. And it's usually a step down. But I would have to look to make absolutely sure. But it is tied to the underlying offense.
Okay, thank you. A follow-up? Again, through the chair, just to be clear, when we talk about involving a minder on line 8, page 25 in section 36, is there allowances for if the individual is the minor? In other words, the perpetrator, the person who's convicted of solicitation or some other crime is in fact a minor or age 20, if age 21 is our definition of minor in the bill, if they are at 20 years old, you know, convicted of, say, solicitation, is that the person that's going to have their certificate revoked for life?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, are you asking about if the person perhaps was a juvenile when they may have been adjudicated or something for, if they're a juvenile, they're not convicted. They are adjudicated, so they wouldn't fall under the definition of conviction. But if the person is over 18, I think that they would be captured in the definition of conviction.
Follow. So, yeah, and I'm particularly thinking, since we're changing the age to 21, 18, 19, or 20-year-olds that are convicted, these are the people who, among others, would have their certificate revoked for life. Is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it's unclear to me how anyone who's 19 has a teaching license, because this is a revocation of a license. So this is somebody who already has a license. I think the instances of somebody being that young and having a license are pretty rare.
Well, I'm not thinking of 20-year-old teachers as much as the way I read it, a teacher of any age who maybe when they were 20, was found guilty of this crime, or they committed it when they were 20 and then was later found guilty. I'm thinking that this might involve that subset of people. I'm wondering, is that accurate?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, that they would be captured by this language, yes.
Okay, thank you.
Any further questions from committee members? Representative Gray.
Thank you. Through the chair, I have a question about page 7. Line 14. So this is defining prostitution in the third degree. A person commits the crime of prostitution in the third degree if the person offers a fee in exchange for sexual conduct, whether the intended recipient is the person or someone else. I don't know what that means.
I can take that. So this language, the words, whether the intended recipient is the person or someone else, was recommended be removed by legal as being moot. The crime is if you offer in exchange for sexual conduct, that is prostitution in the third degree. But that was a request that was made by Representative Eastman that he said, what if they're buying sex for someone else? They're not going to engage in it. So that's where the language came from, is to capture that. But according to legislative legal and Department of Law, both agreed that that language, it captures what that is. So We can remove that, and it's still, if they purchase sex, whether it's for them or someone else, it's the same crime.
Follow up. When I read lines 16 through 18 about what prostitution in the fourth degree is, if we take out that other, can I just get an explanation for the difference between prostitution in the third degree and prostitution in the fourth degree if we remove that language about someone else?
Ms. Schroeder.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, we tend to agree with Ledge Legal about that language and that it's superfluous. It does not add or detract from the language. So prostitution in the third degree, as drafted in the CS, is someone offering a fee in exchange for sexual conduct. So prostitution in the fourth degree is someone agreeing to engage in sexual conduct in exchange for a fee. So that's the distinction between the conduct.
Oh. So in this case, third degree, sorry, follow up. So buying the sex act is third degree, and being paid for the sex act is fourth degree?
That's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And just for clarification, these degrees of prostitution are in current statute. Those were not changed, and the degree of the classification is in current statute. But because we added prostitution in the second degree and in the first degree, we needed to further clarify. So those are the additions to the prostitution statutes, and it made it more clear by having different degrees rather than the way it is currently written in statute.
Madam Chair, if I might, for the record, Jay Galmita, Chief of Staff to Rep Vance, walking through Section 11 again very quickly. So prostitution in the first degree is referring to, for lack of a better term, the manager of a brothel, someone that runs a brothel. That's prostitution in the first degree. Prostitution in the second and the third degree would apply to, for again, lack of a better term, the Johns, a patron of prostitution, the recidivist, someone who repeats doing it. And then prostitution in the fourth degree, again, is left alone. That is the person who is choosing to be a sex worker. So I hope that helps.
Representative Gray.
I have a question about a completely different section, if that's okay, Madam Chair.
Yes.
If we can go to page 23 of the bill, this is a question, and it might be a question to the chair, about the decision to not have a vacation of drug offenses. And the reason why is because I feel that the testimony that we heard from victims of sex trafficking was so compelling about being forced to use drugs and ultimately, being forced to become a drug addict. And so I think that there's a good argument to be made that if they were sex trafficked and then later convicted of a drug offense, that you could directly tie that to having been sex trafficked. And so I understand the not wanting to overburden the court system with thousands of people asking for a judgment to be vacated, but I wonder if we have any evidence from another state that that actually happened. That there actually is evidence to support that we would be overwhelmed, because it might actually be a very small number of folks that come forward and say that they want their drug offense to be vacated because they were indeed the victim of sex trafficking.
Representative Gray, I share your concern in this. However, when we were discussing the process of someone requesting that the judgment be vacated, it seemed like we have not outlined what that clear process should look like and the fiscal note that could potentially be included. After conversations with members, it just felt like we needed to take a deeper dive into that, and I didn't want that issue to slow down the progress of what we have. It's very clear that you can link prostitution convictions with someone who was trafficked in the process that Department of Law and the courts outlined that they feel would be taken at this time doesn't seem overly burdensome. But when you include all of the research of the drug convictions and the process of Department of Law looking at that to make sure, was this person indeed trafficked that is requesting this? That seemed really fuzzy to me, and it's not something that I want to dismiss, but maybe we could address at a further time, because I think it deserves further review.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have another question about a different section, but if somebody else has other questions, you can come back to me.
I think Vice Chair Allard on this topic.
Thank you. And it's going to piggyback off of what Representative Gray said. I, too, have that concern, because I remember the conversation being that we weren't going to charge those individuals that may have been pushed to be addicted to drugs and then pushed into work that they didn't want. I thought we were going to be able to have enough resources, and then if the department wanted to come back and ask for additional dollars, we could. But I thought we were told that we could go ahead and add that in there, and it wouldn't be a fiscal liability at that point. I know. I'm going, and Madam Chair, I respect your decisions. I'm going to say that I'm worried a little bit about pushing something through quickly and then having come back to fix it. And I don't know if this is going to be, we're looking at pushing this through before this session, if I can say on the record, to vote on if there's things that are not hashed out.
Vice Chair Allard, this bill has been introduced the last two sessions, so my entire tenure. So push through is not quite where it's at, but I do share your concerns on that. It's not just the fiscal note that I had concerns about vacating drug convictions. It's the process and making sure that that the persons requesting the vacation of judgment were indeed trafficked, and where it wasn't clear to me how accurate that assessment was going to be, and that's why I chose at this time to remove it.
Can I just do a quick follow-up? I think your comment just made me kind of pivot a little bit, because hearing how long this has taken to get through, sometimes saving some lives is better than saving no lives. So maybe I understand what you're doing, because then if we put this through, we can see what we need to do is tweaking a little bit, but saving some lives is better than none. So yes, I appreciate your thought process. Thank you.
Thank you. And Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And correct me if I'm wrong, but my recollection from watching this bill over the last few years is that the dealing with the drug conviction was a relatively recent addition. Is that right?
I believe it was added last year in judiciary, Representative
okay.
Eastman.
Got it. Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I can see that Nancy Mead is here, and I didn't know if she could just remind us what that possible fiscal note was for the vacation of drug judgments, or like, I mean, do we have a frame of reference if it was a fiscal note concern? Sorry.
Well, there are two, the Department of Law and the courts are involved in this process, and if Ms. Schroeder would like to speak to the Department of Law's piece of it, and then we could invite Ms. Mead.
Madam Chair, for the record, Casey Schroeder, Assistant Attorney General. The fiscal note on this bill in general, even with the drug aspect, was a zero fiscal note for the Department of Law. I believe Ms. Mead had the court system had a positive fiscal note. So it's really a policy call from the Department of Law's perspective.
Ms. Mead.
Thank you, Chair Vance, members of the committee. My name is Nancy Mead, General Counsel for the Alaska Court System. It is the case that the court system had a fiscal note that largely was due to the vacation of the drug convictions. With the vacation of the prostitution convictions only, we would have a one-time temporary position, $37,000. But with the drug ones, we had an ongoing cost of $188,000 per year henceforth. And that was based on the fact that there are about 20,000 cases that we have.
and we estimated 5 or 10% of those would come forward, and that would take an individual to review those on a consistent basis, because even 5,000 petitions coming in, or 500 petitions coming in, excuse me, would necessitate a staff person to handle them. With the adoption of this CS, I've already prepared a revised fiscal note eliminating that ongoing cost. But I will obviously keep monitoring and see where this goes. And if I may, Madam Chair, last year when this was added in the Senate Judiciary Committee, I collected some information from our database about the number of cases with a prostitution conviction and a co-occurring other conviction. And there are actually very few prostitution convictions that also have a drug conviction. And I mean on the order of 3 or 5 or 10. And so it may be that later in their life, the person might have a misdemeanor conviction, and I can't really figure that out. But I can tell you that when somebody has a prostitution conviction, they do not often, they extremely rarely also have a drug conviction in that case, and that may be informative as you think this through.
Thank you, Ms. Dean. That's actually very helpful information. Any further questions from Ms. Mead before she... Thank you. And I just, as I was looking through the fiscal notes, I want to apologize on the explanation of changes. Again, it's been in a flurry getting the CS to try to present before the committee. One of the changes that I did make was to remove the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault from the bill, because I would like to have, that was an addition made from the Senate, I'd like to have further conversations with the senator who brought that in. It appears that the council is kind of at their maximum, and I know that we heard from Ms. Katie Tipas with the governor's council, and they would like to be made permanent. And so right now I'm just asking for clarification on how grants can be distributed to for resources for sex trafficking victims. That was one of the reasons that the Council on Domestic Violence was added to the bill, was so that there would be a recipient for grants and being able to distribute them. So it is nothing against the council being removed. I just felt like maybe they should just be allowed to stay doing what they're doing well, and then we find a further solution on being able to provide resources to those who are trafficked. So again, this is more of an opportunity for conversation among members and also among the other body. But I, in all of our explanation of changes, that one we accidentally omitted. Any further questions from committee members? Representative Eastman, then Representative Gray.
Thank you. Still looking at Section 11, which is the new language we were just looking at earlier. It's obviously a lot of this is coming from existing statute, but since it's new language, it doesn't necessarily point me to which statute or statutes are being drawn from. And I'm specifically looking at Section proposed 11.66.108, which begins on page 7, line 20. And it talks about the persons that are exempt from prosecution. It seems somewhat like it could encompass individuals that we wouldn't necessarily intend to be exempt, because there's a lot of things listed here. I was wondering if we could hear from the department on page 8, line 23, what that subsection is accomplishing in the bill.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, first of all, I think the cross-reference to A1 is a drafting issue that just needs to be corrected. But essentially what this language does is it says that if you are engaging in prostitution and you witness a crime, a much more serious crime, because it would be a crime that's on this list, you can report it without being at risk of being prosecuted for the prostitution. you know, say it's, you know, I witnessed the patron or the buyer do something and I want to report it. But then, of course, we would know that they were engaging in prostitution. And so this whole section of law is designed to give immunity from prosecution, basically. It's a bar on prosecution for reporting those types of offenses when you cooperate with law enforcement.
Just to better understand how that immunity is working or not working. So when it talks about evidence supporting, does that mean all of the evidence the prosecution might use against the person was obtained, you know, as a result of their reporting the crime? Or what about a situation where, you know, 99% of the evidence is obtained through other means and some scintilla of evidence is obtained as a consequence of their reporting? Are we saying that they're immune from prosecution of the 99% as well?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if we could bring a prosecution with the evidence that was not obtained via the person reporting, we could engage in a prosecution. But generally, we don't engage in those types of prosecutions anyway. So essentially, when this was passed, this was codifying practice that we had already been engaging in for a number of years.
Great. Thank you very much.
And Madam Chair, if I could just correct a prior answer I gave to Representative Eastman. Representative Eastman asked about the professional teaching licenses, when they would be pulled. So if somebody committed a crime before, say maybe got their license and then their crime was discovered, the applicability section says that it's for offenses committed on or after the effective date. So it's on or after.
Follow-up. And on that same topic, a lifetime revocation, does that mean, I mean, it clearly means that they lose their previous teaching license. Does that also mean they can't apply for a new one in the future, or is that considered separately?
Through the chair, who represented Beastman, I think it also means that they cannot apply for one in the future. It's a lifetime bar. I think that's the intent. I know it's not said, but there is another section of law that talks about it's permissive as far as issuing a license. And there are, and so I think the commissioner would look at whether or not somebody had had their license revoked for a lifetime for this and been like, they're applying again and I'm not going to issue a license here because it's revoked.
Thank you.
Quiet side of the room. Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to go to page 4. I have two questions on this page. The first one is really a follow-up from our last discussion of this bill. And it has to do with the affirmative defense. So if you start in line 2 and go down, the person reasonably believed that the person to be 18 years of age or older and undertook reasonable measures to verify that the person was 18 years of age or older. I asked Deputy Attorney General about whether it would be a reasonable measure to say you're 18, right? And I was wondering if there's any follow-up on that, because I just feel that asking someone if they're 18 years of age or older in this particular scenario, I feel the vast majority of sex trafficking victims would know that they're supposed to say, yeah, I'm 18. And I just don't think that that's I'm not sure that that's a reasonable verification of age.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, it is a reasonable person standard. So it would be something that would have to be presented to the jury, and you would have to get the jury to believe that. So if the person looked 10 and you said, hey, you're 18, right? And she says, yes, that's not reasonable. You know, checking ID, that might be closer. But, you know, again, if the person looks very, very young and they're saying that they're of age, that's not reasonable, and that's we don't think a jury is going to buy that.
I want to go down on that page, so I hear your answer there. Thank you. This is more philosophical. On line 14, we have induces or causes another person to engage in sexual conduct, adult entertainment, or labor. My question is about the word labor, and this really comes down to that we have a 36-page bill in front of us that is all about sex trafficking, but yet just on the offhand, we've talked about labor trafficking, and we've talked about people being abused, you know, used for their labor. And to me, I wonder from the Department of Law if it might make more sense to have a separate bill on labor trafficking than just have a whole 36-page bill on, you know, sort of sex trafficking, and that to me, I'm afraid that we might be missing some of the nuances and specific issues involved with labor trafficking by having all of this stuff about prostitution and sex trafficking. I feel like it's something different, but maybe you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Through the chair, Representative Gray, this was the policy decision that was made by the administration. And part of the reason why human trafficking is here is a purely drafting legal reason, because we are separating out sex trafficking from human trafficking. Right now, there is overlap. And so we're separating those out. So those amendments need to be made, because as you can see, sexual conduct is bracketed. And then the thought was, since we're here and we know it's a problem, let's try to address that as well. We are aware that there are a whole host of things that can be done with human trafficking. There's licensing issues, things like that. And we're not digging into that in this bill, but since we are cleaning up those statutes and we have the opportunity now to improve them, we seize that opportunity.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard.
Thank you. And through the chair, could you give us the definition of labor used in the legal definition of labor used in this term, please?
Through the chair, Vice Chair Allard, there is no definition in statute, so it would be the definition that you find in the dictionary.
Okay. All right. Thank you. I appreciate that.
And it's been a number of weeks. The very first committee, I asked Mr. Skidmore to clarify why we're separating out human and sex trafficking, because that was one of my issues, is to get us to adopt similar language as the federal definition of human trafficking, which does involve sex trafficking. However, per our statutes, for clarification, we needed that separation. So I have focused mainly on the sex trafficking because of all that other, but if we were to go into further nuances of the human trafficking, which is the sale of people, just like sex trafficking, different purpose, then it would be a 60-page bill. But again, the necessary components and the similar nature is that you're selling people. This is the modern-day slavery, and that is further discussion. But before we move on to that, Ms. Schroeder, could you highlight, the instances that you're aware of that we have for labor trafficking in the state and sex trafficking? I mean, I feel like there's fewer labor trafficking that we're aware of right now in comparison, but can you kind of give us a glimpse of that before we move on?
Madam Chair, I don't think that we prosecute human trafficking as often as we prosecute sex trafficking, and we don't prosecute sex trafficking very often. Like I said, there is legal overlap between the two now, and that would be problematic, indicating then, and since it hasn't risen to the level of being a problem, it indicates that we are not using the statute very much. I do think from discussions in the building, I've been in the building a long time, that labor trafficking is an issue here, for sure. And I think that professionals who engage in businesses that those types of businesses are often used. I'm not saying that those people are doing it, but those businesses are sometimes used as covers for labor trafficking. Those people have come to the legislature in the past and asked for changes to try to address some of that. So it looks to me like, just based on my historical experience, that the human trafficking has been attempted to be addressed through licensing issues and, requirements for obtaining licenses and things like that, as opposed to the criminal code.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. On that topic, in Section 7, dealing with human trafficking, can you talk to us, why are we making the changes here, particularly the text that's being deleted, which focuses on obtaining a benefit from human trafficking, and now we're replacing it effectively with, intent to promote human trafficking, and I'm wondering, is that a less restrictive definition of the crime of human trafficking in the second degree? If before attaining a benefit was sufficient to be convicted, and now you can obtain a benefit, but as long as you don't do it with the intent to promote human trafficking or whatever that is, then you wouldn't be susceptible to conviction? Or can you help us understand that?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, under current law, there are far fewer degrees of human trafficking. And what we did is when we were amending human trafficking, we mirrored the changes that were made in sex trafficking. And so this obtains a benefit language was removed because we were trying to mirror what the approach for second degree sex trafficking. And the logic also was that human trafficking in the third degree may help address that language as well, because the language in third degree talks about providing resources and things like that. So it's not exactly the same fit, but we thought that this conduct, we were raising it to an A felony, and this conduct we did not think was A felony. We thought it was something lower, and we tried to capture some of that with the third degree language, although I admit it is not a direct fit.
Paula? So where does that leave me? If I'm profiting or obtaining a benefit from human trafficking, I think currently that's a crime. Is that no longer a crime, or does that fall in one of these other degrees?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I think it depends on how you were obtaining that benefit. If you were engaging in some sort of conspiracy or something like that, you would be captured by the conspiracy statute, and so you would be picked up that way. It just depends on how remote the benefit is that you're receiving. So if you're actually engaging in something that you know to be human trafficking, that maybe you yourself are not inducing or causing, but you're getting the money from it or something like that, you can probably be charged as a co-defendant or under some sort of conspiracy theory.
And this whole intent to promote human trafficking, I mean, I'm picturing someone with a billboard saying human trafficking is great, which obviously not what we're talking about here. What do we mean when we say intent to promote human trafficking? I mean, it seems kind of amorphous.
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, it is. It is intent to promote human trafficking. So this crime is a specific intent crime, meaning that the person's conscious objective has to be to promote or act in furtherance of human trafficking. So they have to know what they're doing is furthering the sale of people, the sale of labor, and they have to intend, that has to be their conscious objective. So it's a higher mental state for sure, but it would be determined on a case-by-case basis.
And I'm assuming, kind of without having asked, so I'm asking, so if someone is here in the legislature saying human trafficking is a good thing, you know, change the laws, they're not going to get wrapped up under this, are they?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, absolutely not.
Thank you.
Representative Gray.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Page 5, and I don't have the Alaska statutes in front of me, but on line 9, when it says the applicability of those statutes do not apply to acts that may reasonably be construed to be a normal caretaker request of a child or a normal interaction with a child, can you speak to that?
To the chair, Representative Gray, that was an addition that was made in Senate Judiciary last year, because there was some concern that the way the statutes were drafted, that they could capture parenting behaviors such as, I'm not going to give you this pair of jeans unless you shovel the driveway, right? So that would be withholding somebody's clothing and asking for labor in exchange. And so this language was added to try to address that concern and make clear that that is absolutely not what we're talking about.
Follow up. So in the next section, so like lines 12 through 16, we're talking about human trafficking. And just correct me, are we talking about children right now or anybody in this particular section?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, we're talking about anybody, and this section applies to sex and human trafficking. And this language is in current law. It was added by the legislature after a case came out a long time ago in the 70s, I think, that suggested that when we are prosecuting sex trafficking specifically, the word of a sex worker is not good enough. Now, that's not the case for any other case. And I think that this language was enacted as a result in response to that case to be like, hey, no, that's not the case here either. But I will tell you that this is the state of the law for all cases. It's not required that we bring in corroborating evidence. It's probably a good idea. Our burden is beyond a reasonable doubt, but there's nothing that says that we have to bring in 3 witnesses, 5 witnesses, stacks of evidence. It's based on the jury's assessment of the credibility of the witnesses. So this is why this language is there. It was carried over because sometimes when we delete things that are in statute, the courts think that we meant to change something. And I would suggest that this is probably not needed in the bill. However, if the committee removes it, we would just want a record made that, hey, we're not intending to change the state of the law. We just think this language is archaic.
Representative Eastman.
Thank you. On the line below that, talking about forfeiture for a moment, the language on line 17 is property used. And I know sometimes in statute we address the property itself, which is, of course, an inanimate object, and sometimes we're addressing the property owner. Is there a distinction here in this section on whether or not the owner had some intent or some knowingness dealing with the property before it can be forfeited? If someone borrows my car and uses it for human trafficking, is that property that could be forfeited now?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, we could institute a forfeiture action on that property. You would have an opportunity to come in and be like, hey, I had no idea that this was happening. And then a judge could consider whether or not that was credible and whether or not he was going to allow us to forfeit. So I think that would still be available for you.
Thank you.
Any further questions from committee members? Now's your opportunity. Representative Gray.
Madam Chair, this is a question. Can we do it at ease?
At ease. On record, just for clarification, we are not moving this bill out today. This is we are still under consideration of adoption of this committee substitute as our new working document. So with that, are there any further questions? Representative Eastman.
Thank you. I'm looking at section 9 of the bill, and I think this also parallels both on human trafficking and sex trafficking, but regardless, I see on line 26, page 5, that we're defining actions that constitute inducing or causing. And we kind of use the word includes, and then we have a list of things. Is that list exclusive, or is there another list? Or if that list is on the bottom end, where is the top end of what constitutes an action or actions that constitute inducing or causing?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, the list is not exclusive. It's not all inclusive. So we could make argument that other conduct that's not on the list would qualify as inducing or causing. What I would say is that in current law, the law uses the words induce or cause, and there is not a list. So there is no guidance from the legislature, and so we are free to make any argument. This at least provides some guidelines as to what we think the legislature thinks inducing or causing is. So I think that this provides more direction than what's in current law, but it would be open to argument and open for it would be a jury question ultimately.
In conversations that I've had with law enforcement and others, families who have had their daughters trafficked, and from the victims themselves, including language like instilling in a person a fear that the lodging, food, clothing, or medication will be withheld from a person, threatening to report arrest, taking their ID, all of those things have been listed as direct link to trafficking and is part of that inducing or causing. And I think it would this specific clarification has been requested to be included because it is one of those elements of coercion, which is addressed in another area in the next section, actually. But this is a by request of those who have experienced it. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. And on that, adult entertainment is listed in the same line, and I'm just wondering to what extent adult entertainment is being brought in here, which, of course, is not generally considered sex trafficking. So why is it listed here under the inducing or causing?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, this list applies to both sex trafficking and human trafficking. Both those statutes in the bill use the term induce or cause, so this applies to both. And as you know, in human trafficking, we talk about adult entertainment and labor. And so that's the reference back to the human trafficking statutes.
Thank you.
I know this is a lot to put on the committee, and I thank you for your indulgence. And it's a lot to cover, so don't feel that you have to understand everything right away. Representative Eastman.
Thank you. So further on inducing and causing, can you be guilty of inducing or causing if the act is never inducted or never takes place? I wanted something to happen, and I was taking action, which if it had happened, would have caused it to happen. But if the actual crime doesn't take place, am I still guilty of trying to make it take place through inducing or causing it?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, if you take a substantial step in furtherance of the offense, you can be guilty of an attempt. But if you do nothing and you just want to do something, but there's no act, we're miles away from attempt. So that's not going to be a crime.
And on that, is there a different level of legal liability that attaches to someone whether or not the sex trafficking took place? Their actions didn't change under inducing or causing, but someone else's actions changed, and maybe the person decided at the last minute not to be a victim of sex trafficking, and they had that option or something like that. What does that affect what I can be prosecuted for, or what someone who is inducing or causing something can be prosecuted for?
Through the chair, Representative Eastman, I want to make sure I understand your hypothetical. The person does not do anything to induce or cause, or the victim doesn't actually engage in the sexual act?
No. Scenario A is someone takes action which induces or causes, and the sex trafficking takes place, and they are later found guilty of inducing or causing. Scenario B is the person does exactly the same things to induce or cause it to happen. Someone else makes a different decision, and the sex trafficking doesn't actually happen. Is there a difference in legal liability to the first person in those two scenarios?
Through the chair to Representative Eastman, if the sexual conduct does not take place, if the person engages in conduct that would have been inducer of a causing, but the sexual conduct does not take place, it could potentially be an attempt if the inducing or causing is considered a substantial step. And that would have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis.
Thank you.
Vice Chair Allard.
Okay, so through the chair. I know, we're like, So it's almost like if someone solicits for murder, but they don't go through with it. So recruitment, right? I mean, is that...
Through the chair, Vice Chair Allard, solicitation could apply there. Solicitation could include other things like payment and things like that. That could also be an attempt. But that's covered under a different set of statutes. But we have general statutes governing solicitation, conspiracy, and attempt that apply to all the criminal code.
I think we're just trying through the chair. Thank you. I think we're just trying not to miss anything.
Right.
If it was me, I'd throw in the kitchen sink. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Gray.
Thank you. Can we look at page 11? I assume this is talking about the statute of limitations and adding sex trafficking as being not subject to the statute of limitations, that it could be brought forth at any time. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Representative Gray, on line 31, it is applying to sex trafficking in the first and second degree and that would be no statute of limitations, so it could be brought at any time. And then on page 12, line 9, that's sex trafficking in the third degree and human trafficking in the third degree, and that has a statute of limitations of 10 years.
Thank you. Yes, and then the 5 years, I didn't understand on page 12 how it was 10 years, and then at line 11 it says 5 years after the commission of any offense. So 10 years after the commission of a felony offense in violation of that, and then 5 years, of any other offense.
Correct. Yes.
I don't know what that means.
Through the chair, Representative Gray. So if you look at A1 and then B, all of those things are listing, and they're listing offenses where there are specific statute of limitations. Either it's no statute of limitations or it's 10 years. And if it's not listed in that list, it's okay. Any other offense, and the statute of limitations is 5 years.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Gray, I'd just like to say I love having you on committee for asking so many questions, just like Representative Eastman, because I, too, am that legislator. I think it's good to have clarification when we are passing substantial law, and it helps for the legislative record. So thank you for that. Any further questions? Okay. Representative Johnson, do you maintain your objection?
I do not.
Hearing none, committee substitute for House Bill 68 version S has been adopted as our new working document. So the final deadline for this will be Friday, April 14th by 5 p.m. And I encourage members to, feel free to reach out to me, have discussions about ideas. Ms. Schroeder's available with the Department of Law of just what you think you may want. There was some things that I said, well, I want to do this. And they said, well, it's already covered here, or this will conflict with that. So please engage in conversation, because it makes the amendment process go that much easier, and getting them back on time from Ledge Legal. They've been amazing in working through this. Vice Chair Eller, did you have a question?
I do. Today's Wednesday. Are you saying 2 days to get our amendments back from legal, or are we going to have... I say that because I just put in a whole bunch of amendments, deadlines, and I just don't know how they're going to pull it off, but I'm just curious. I don't know how I'm going to pull off my amendments that soon, but I'm a little worried.
How about I set it for Friday at 5 p.m., and then I can ask...
Okay, fair enough.
I can ask legal what they see as reality, and because the whole goal is that we all have a bill that we feel that we can come to an agreement on and pass good law. So, we're going to have a few technical things, but if we can work together and not have, a huge stack, because things make sense, it makes it easier for them and easier for our process of being able to move on this bill. So that concludes our business for today. The House Judiciary Committee will meet again on Friday, April 14th at 1 p.m. to consider the governor's appointees, hold a first hearing on SB 80, the 2023 Revisers Bill by the Senate Rules Committee at request of Legislative Council, and then we'll bring back House Bill 28, Access to Marijuana Conviction Records, by Representative Wright. Seeing there is no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect, it is 2:09 p.m.